Hey, welcome back to the Bill Bennett Show. Thoughtful conversation about the news of the day, and we address the existential threats to America. And Joe Biden thought he did that last night at the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that in our monthly special, Scholars and Sense. So joining us today, Conrad Black, author, columnist, and media contributor, and Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at Hoover, focuses classics and military history. But first, a few things I want to get off my chest.
Did you watch any of the speech last night? We're going to get into it with Victor Davis Hanson and Conrad Black, but what are some of your initial thoughts?
Yeah, I did watch about half of it. Feisty, he held his energy, showed some energy, which we'll congratulate him on, but not the unifier, that's for damn sure. came out with, fists, double fists aimed at Republicans and supporters of Republicans. Aimed at the MAGA crowd, as he calls it, all 74 million of us, I guess. He was angry, and angry tone. We're going to pass this. We're going to pass that. Had his supporters in the House and Senate roaring. They were very excited to see such energy in this old guy. Made a few muffs, of course. We expect that of him. But I have to give him, a performance grade that was pretty good in terms of sticking to his, getting his energy up and punching away. But that's all I can think of is punching. He was really punching. Your impressions?
So number one, I agree with everything you said. I'll get to that in a second. But the first thing I thought about after the speech was, man, the picture that he painted about this country, America, was a great one. But I just wish that it was the reality of what most of us are living. It wasn't. He painted a picture of America that isn't the reality of what most people are dealing with. When he talked about the economy and he talked about, crime being down and things like that. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not what everybody is facing. We watched this speech and I watched some analysis. Then I turn on the local news and there's video of people in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, in a Crocs store stealing all the Crocs while the employees stand by. And this happens in a lot of major American cities. And, he talked about the immigration bill, which is fine. But, you've been in office for 3 years and it didn't seem to be a priority then. And now it's a priority. It just wasn't an accurate picture of what most people are dealing with. But I do agree 100% with the fact that he showed energy. I felt like the Democrats there were trying to keep his energy up by standing and clapping. My wife noticed this, that, VP Harris stood up and sat down more than any VP that I remember in history of me, at least watching State of the Union speeches. She's up and down, and everybody else kind of is after everything he says, because I think that they felt like they had to show support. And I do think that they were energized by the fact that he seemed energized. It was some classic Joe Biden that we've seen before, where he didn't mind sparring back and forth with some of the hecklers and on the Republican side. He was fine with it, going back and forth with them. That's, what he does.
What? You don't agree with me? What? You can't read? What? Yeah. I think you can read.
Yeah. And so, going back and forth like that's kind of classic Joe. I think that if you're a Democrat that is desperately hoping that Joe Biden can beat former President Trump, you left feeling okay about feeling okay, if that makes any sense. Like, not that you're fully convinced, but you were at least felt good about last night. That can give you enough juice for the next few months, hoping you can get to the election. But I just wish that the picture he painted about our country was true. Now, here's one other thing that I will say. This is if the Republicans want to steal anything from President Biden's playbook, is that he does, whether you agree with them or not, he presented ideas. I think that Republicans have to get out of this no, no, no thing and start presenting some ideas. I mean, even back to the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare stuff, it's not enough to just say this is not going to work, repeal and replace. We'll replace it with what? Come up with something. And there are issues that I'm looking at. And while some of the ideas that the Biden administration may be far-fetched, doesn't seem like it's a good idea, or how you're going to fund this kind of stuff, or it's not going to work, it's at least an idea that's specific, where I don't see that coming from the Republican side, and I think that they need to do that.
Yeah. My wife said she goes to the schools in D.C., and teachers say, why won't Republicans sign on to this, this immigration bill? Well, because it's just creating more bureaucrats. It's not reducing the numbers. And he can reduce the numbers with a click of a finger with Remain in Mexico. So right. It's a dodge. But, yeah, they need to put their alternatives, their policy alternatives in front of the American people. And I think they haven't done it. They've had so much infighting and who's going to be speaker and all that. Mm-hmm. Seems to be resolved now, at least for the moment. So let's get the agenda moving. What are you guys going to do? Apart from criticizing Joe Biden, I think that's pretty fair.
Yeah, and come up with a three-point plan. Here's a plan for the border. Here's a plan for economics. Here's a plan for crime. Or whatever your three or four are going to be, do it. Come up with something that everyone can agree with. And I don't like this, but if you have to, go ahead and get former President Trump to sign off on it, or at least, you know, agree with it or endorse it if you feel like you need to. Fine. But at least come up with 3 to 4 specific plans with big agenda items that here's what we're for. Because at some point, you've got to be for something and not just against it. And that's one thing that I think that they could take from last night. Okay, well, let's come up with some alternatives that are specific. That we want to do. Not just we want to secure the border. Okay, but how? Come up with that stuff.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, I salute you on that. I think you're right. And I think the party would be well served, the Republican Party would be well served to follow your advice on this. So good for you. We'll see.
But, we haven't done a show since former Governor Nikki Haley dropped out of the race. Anything you want to say about that?
No, I mean, yeah, she's there in the wings. I hope her people will come back to Trump. They need to. If they don't, he doesn't win. Because as popular as he is in the primary season, he is not popular overall. And his overall popularity is actually lower than Biden's in the nation overall. I believe that's correct, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. So, you know, he's got to do that. So what that means concretely is he needs to get her voters and other voters. And some of the never Trumpers and the moderates in the middle and all those folks. And let's see if he can do that. I don't know if he can, but he'll have to. He'll really have to. That's the task. You know, one thing, you know, my football stuff, but when he mentioned the name of this poor slain woman in Georgia, Lincoln Riley, and he called her Lincoln Riley,
mm-hmm.
who is the USC football coach,
all right.
formerly of Oklahoma. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was the coach of our guy, Caleb Williams, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Gonzaga. Your school.
Got my school, my high school right here, Inner City High School. Yeah. And, he called her Lincoln Riley.
Right.
Unfortunate, really unfortunate. But, you know, he's going to do that sort of thing. I don't know what effect, $450 million has on him, I think, pretty big. Under $92 million, that's added to it. And I don't know if this has any more effect on the American people or not. I just don't know. I'm really sorry to see Mike Gallagher is stepping down from Congress. He had that special subcommittee on China. He's now, I guess, going to spend full time with the Green Bay Packers.
He'll be doing some other things, I'm sure. But yeah, he'll be back in Wisconsin.
Yeah but I mean, that's a real loss. I think he just got tired of the whole Senate game, you know. We'll take up a lot of this with Victor and Conrad, get their reactions. And then we want yours. If people want to give us their reaction, how do they do that, Claude?
Just send an email to BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. And I promise you in the next episode, Bill and I will read some emails.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Bill Bennett Show.
Hey, everybody, it's Claude from The Bill Bennett Show. And we all know what a roller coaster the stock market can be. And I get on that ride every morning, although I probably shouldn't. I'm always checking to see how my portfolio was doing, different stocks to invest in. And it is a roller coaster. But did you know that silver can help offset these dips and bumps? That's right, silver. So historically, during a market roller coaster, silver has always been a steady friend. Not only is it a tangible asset, but right now the silver to gold ratio is at a record high. And silver isn't just a safe haven, it's in demand across multiple industries, electronics, solar panels, medical devices, and more. The consistent demand supports the value of silver even when the markets are all over the place. The opportunity to add silver to your collection won't get much better than this. If you want to learn more, go see our friends at CSN Mint, your go-to for certified U.S. Mint collectible coins and precious metals for over 20 years. I have these coins in my possession, in the house. And I'm telling you, it adds yet another layer of security to your financial portfolio in these turbulent times. When you're ready to make that smart move, go to csnmint.com/build and use promo code BILL at checkout to get free silver American Eagle, over $30 in value with your purchase of $75 or more. That's csnmint.com/bill and use the promo code BILL at checkout. Again, csnmint.com/bill. You got to use the promo code BILL.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Joining me now, Conrad Black and Victor Davis Hanson. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show. Let's jump right in. So, State of the Union, we were talking offline, Victor, about the speech, your first impressions.
Yeah, I guess I acted a little bit. I have a pretty strong view. I haven't seen or heard a speech like that before, a State of the Union. They're usually bad, but I've never seen a more partisan, angry. I've never seen a president directly attack Supreme Court justices in his presence like that or interact with the opposition. And the other thing about it is, he looked almost reptilian. He was angry. He was shouting the whole time. And he only becomes animated when he attacks his domestic opposition. He doesn't get animated over the Houthis, the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese. But you mention anybody that's associated with Donald Trump or conservatives, he just starts shouting and barking and screaming. And then the other problem very quickly was most of it was just untrue. I mean, we're spending printing $1 trillion every 100 days. In his 8 years, if he were to be here 8 years, he would add $22 trillion to the debt.
My God.
He's already added 7. And so the thing about the border, it's an election year, but he let in 8 to 10 million people. And that was not because he didn't have the law or the money. He just reversed about 100 executive orders of Trump. Roe versus Wade, nobody's trying to outlaw abortion. It's up to the states to decide. Everybody knows that. I could go on, but it was just a kingdom of lies. I had a really visceral reaction to it. I really thought it's going to help Donald Trump because he is now the voice of normalcy. He's going to be running as a return to, you know, normality.
Civility
and normality, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
This election will be civilization versus chaos.
Donald Trump, a return to civility.
Yeah.
I love it.
I've been listening to these things since, I guess, as you guys have, since Eisenhower's time. And I never heard a State of the Union speech where there was a partisan comment or where an opponent was even mentioned. And I think I agree with you, Victor. I think there are a great many people who know that that speech was full of lies and many who would object to such an outrageous attack on the Supreme Court. You saw even the Democratic appointed justices sitting on their hands. They weren't applauding him. But I will say, I mentioned offline that I think his first constituency was his own Democrats to show he was vigorous. And I think he may have succeeded with them.
He did.
Yeah, I don't. Let me say something about Supreme Court. There has been criticism before in the State of the Union, as I recall. I didn't check it out, but don't you remember an Obama State of the Union where he criticized Alito?
Single judgment, though. I mean,
yeah, he said that's
this
a lie.
Was an
Alito
attack.
Member. Yeah, and it was, but it wasn't. It wasn't a direct address to a Supreme Court justice, as this was. He looked right at him and he talked directly to them. He was talking of the Supreme Court in a third person, Obama was. He didn't have a...
Yeah, but of course, they were there. And Alito was there.
And he's never come back after
that.
And Alito's never come back after that.
No, I know. Yeah. Right. Is that right? He hadn't come back for any State of the Unions? Wow. Didn't realize. So where does that leave us in terms of the election? Am I correct, gentlemen, that... overall, not in the primary, but overall with the American people, Joe Biden's negatives are very high, but Trump's are even a little higher.
I think until 6 weeks ago, that was true. But if you look at the Real Clear Politics negatives, the person with the highest negatives of public figures in Washington is Mitch McConnell. And the second person is Kamala Harris. And Donald Trump is about 4 points less unpopular than Joe Biden. Less negative. And that's new. That's happened over the last 2 months. I think it's
the general public. For the general public.
I think it's a result of the lawfare, especially the outrageous Letitia James and E. Jean Carroll verdicts, and then the Fannie Willis implosion. I think people are starting to get the more attention it's drawn to these four criminal and one civil suits, the worse it looks.
And that other civil suit about his over exaggerating his asset value. The award is so preposterous. I think that's, you see, I've said here before that the Trump haters hated isn't the Trump they see now. Now they see an underdog and they can identify with him a bit.
That's exactly right. And he's done some positive every once in a while, maybe 50% of the time. That Iowa speech was good. The town hall with Laura Ingraham was pretty good. He had some good moments in South Carolina. If he can just forget about Nikki Haley or forget about the personal invective, and when he calls for unity and everybody, he will be able to campaign in 50 states. And I think he should do that.
But he needs Nikki Haley's people, doesn't he?
He does.
To win.
I think he should get on the phone and call her up and say, you don't like me and I don't like you. And we said some bad things, but compared to what Biden is, we need each other. And you have two choices. If you don't endorse me and I win, your persona non grata. If you don't endorse me and I lose, they're going to blame you. But if you endorse me and I win, you're set for 2028. And if I lose, nobody's going to be angry at you. So it's a win-win to endorse him for her. And it's a lose-lose if she doesn't.
I'm sure they'll get there. I don't think there's that much bad blood between them.
Yeah.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. So do you guys believe that if the election were held a day and it was fair, you know, no cheating, that he would win, that Trump would win?
I do. I can I add a point? I think that Victor referred to the Real Clear Politics average of polls. All but Rasmussen and Trafalgar, I think, are polls conducted by left-wing universities and left-wing media outlets, and they traditionally underestimate Trump. So I think his lead is bigger than what is there. And apart from that, if you take out the Republican victories in Texas, Florida, and let's say Missouri, and the Democratic victories in California and New York, they come to about the same number of electoral votes, but the Republicans get 4 million less votes. So if you add that back into the other 45 states, I think it's a big win for Trump. I think he's well ahead. I don't think it's so close right now. So Biden has to catch up to him.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think we're going to see this State of the Union was sort of the template for what's going to follow all the way to November. He's not going to be out campaigning. They're going to, every week or so, they're going to give him 24 hours rest, maybe give him some Adderall or something or caffeine, and he's going to go out and just scream and yell and then go back into his bunker.
Victor and Bill, the people buy Trump equals Hitler? I mean, we had him for 4 years as president. That wasn't Hitler.
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't think so. But remember this, too, in reviewing the history and the polls and all that, the Democrats say, and I think they're right, that over the past few years, polls have underestimated the Democrat vote or turnout. Remember the trickle, which wasn't the tsunami and other, midterm things, and that they do better during the real election than in the polls. Now, do they do that because they cheat or because they are so good at this game of pre-registering people, of getting those mail-in ballots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, aggressive campaigning and recruiting and getting people to sign? I don't know, but it still worries me some. Yes.
Yeah, it's worrisome. But in those cases that they refer to, Trump himself wasn't there. I mean, the Republicans without Trump are not so formidable as the Republicans with Trump.
But they haven't won. They have, out of the last eight elections, the only popular presidential vote they won was in 2004.
Yeah, and that's because Karl Rove put all his referendums for him.
And then they haven't won 51%, I think, since George H.W. Bush beat Dukakis. So there's been a problem with the national ticket. And Trump was, for all of his new approaches, the MAGA, he wasn't able to win 2016, the popular vote. I think he probably lost because of California and what Conrad said, the 2020 popular vote. So they have a problem. But this time, I think that the reason that they're, that the lawfare is continuing and will accelerate and the invective and this, they are very, very scared because everything they've done has boomeranged. And I think the speech, when he says, let Joe Biden be Joe Biden, what they mean is let me go out and scream and yell and say anything I can. And they said, go ahead. And that's
it's rubber Bork all over again.
Yeah.
I need a break from all the election stuff because it's just on and on and on. And so I've been doing research on another topic. Can I just summarize it to you guys and see what we think? This is, you know, excuse me, the guy say? Every anthropologist loves his own tribe. I'm an education guy. So turns out that we were missing students from school pre-COVID. When we got to COVID, that intensified, obviously, dramatically. But since COVID, they continue to be missing. And it's possible COVID taught them, man, maybe I don't need to be here. Maybe nobody cares whether I'm here or not. And so there's a huge, we don't know the number, but we know it's big, number of students who are missing. They're not being homeschooled either. They're just missing. These students, by the way, tend to be the students who need school the most, or arguably so. They're from the big cities. They're from poorer families. They're kids who need to go to school, and they're not going. You know, many people, middle class, upper middle class, wealthy, saw what was going on in COVID, pull their kids, put them in a charter or a private or a classical academy. But that's not happening so much in the inner city, except the Bronx is actually an exception to that. But I wonder what you all think. What was the message that kids got about school during COVID that would discourage them from going, particularly these kids who need it the most? Any thoughts?
I think it was the combination of the post George Floyd woke and also the COVID lockdown. I think there was a general sense that teachers should not enforce rules of decorum or promptness or attendance, that these were now going to be politicized. And a lot of teachers just thought, you know, I'm not going to die on the altar of standards and be called a systemic racist or something by enforcing those codes. I know that in a different realm, I was just talking yesterday to a faculty member at Stanford, and his basic point was that this is the third year of repertory admissions, and he was not going to die on the altar of standards by having a pattern that was felt to be illiberal. And I said, well, what are your choices? He said, we can either diminish the workload or give A's and inflate the grades or introduce new gut courses. So I said, what are you doing? He said, all three.
Well, three. At Stanford.
Yeah. Well, they just announced it last week that of the admissions, 21% were white. There's no SAT required, and 55% females. So when you let in about 1,900 students and you are admitting about 200 of them, 190 are white males, and out of the white males come the athletes, the children of administrators, big donors, you're down to about 50 or 60 white males in a campus of, you know, 8,000 undergraduates that got in on their own merits. And that means the middle class kids are just not there, and they're not there. And so
how many of those kids are Asian, by the way?
Well, the Asian, because of the lawsuits, even though their population, the general, is about 12%, they're about 30% now. Mm-hmm. And the other groups are about 5 to 8% overrepresented in their demographics.
Yeah.
But the difference is, if you don't require the SAT and you don't adjudicate the value, relative value of a GPA, depending on the quality of a high school, then you really have no way, and you're letting people in by gender and race and sexual orientation. At some point after 3 years of this, two things are happening. One is all of these middle class, upper middle class, professional class liberals, all of them are, I guess you would say, furious at Stanford University. We've been a beneficiary at Hoover because they've diverted a lot of their Stanford money to the Hoover Institution in millions of dollars. But more importantly, they're angry that they didn't think that their own politics would ever come home to roost for them. And then the other thing,
Victor, wouldn't most of the otherwise meritorious candidates go to a good university? Maybe not as good as Stanford is thought to be, but that doesn't mean they don't go to university. They go to, it's not for me to say, University of California at some campus or something.
Oh, no, it's the same at Yale, Harvard, and Princeton, I think.
But Yale hasn't yield. Look, you guys know, I don't know anything.
It's a little, Stanford is the most, is the most restrictive. Yale is and Harvard are restrictive. But when I say restrictive, I mean if there's 67% so-called white people and you're letting in 20% of them and Yale is letting in 40%, maybe yeah. Harvard 45%, then they're going to places. I have a person that works for me whose kids were brilliant and they went to, I think, Michigan State and one is going, went to Johns Hopkins and was on the waiting list for months. And so I guess this racial segregation is really starting to affect people because if it's not a matter of race, it's just a matter if you're not requiring what, if you say you're Stanford University and up till 2020, you said you needed almost a 750 on the SAT and a 4.5 at a competitive high school, you would not be able to do the work at Stanford that was so rigorous and your bachelor's degree would mean so much. And then suddenly, you say, well, all that was a lie. We're going to let in the next 3 years people who can't meet the standards that we used to require. Then the employers are starting to notice. I mean, everybody, doesn't mean much.
But isn't more Stanford committing suicide than worthy students not getting to a good university? And the other thing, did I not see that Yale is bringing back SAT?
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, Dartmouth is. Yale is thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Was it maybe the start of a wave here?
Do you know why they're bringing back the SAT?
Yeah, I do.
Because it's reliable as hell.
It's the bet. You're absolutely right.
It scared the hell out of me when I had to take it.
It's the best indicator of college preparedness
and success at college.
The professional schools are even more preparatory. In reparations admissions. Just to finish, Stanford Law School, 17% of the graduating class flunked the California bar on the first test.
Yeah, but let's go back to the little kids, the younger kids. You know, my little story, you know, my thing here. What's affecting them? They're not dropping out of school because they want to go to Stanford the easy way.
They're dropping out of school because they got acculturated that they didn't have to physically be present. And then second, there's an impression there's no deterrence. They feel that the teaching staff and the administration does not uniformly apply rules of conduct and attendance. And
yeah.
So they're just urchins, is that it? We're getting millions of urchins.
My wife works in the D.C. schools. She's been talking to a lot of teachers and parents and kids and determined the following, at least her conclusions were. They're not going because they don't see the need, and they figured that out during COVID. Also, they don't think anybody misses them if they don't show. And school needs to matter to people, and the school doesn't seem to matter or care about a lot of these kids. And they're also worried about going to school and what they'll hit on the street and fighting and bullying and knife fights and everything else and craziness. So, they've just given up on that way of succeeding in America, which is very bad for them and very bad for us, seems to me.
It really, the parents have to make them go, don't they? I don't know.
You know, it's striking.
A lot of the parents have given up.
Yeah. It's really striking how fragile civilization is. I mean, in just 3 years, when you look at what happened at the border or smash and grab or carjackings, or suddenly we woke up one morning and these pharmacies have everything locked up. And it's really weird how quickly. I mean, I was on Market Street not too long ago. It looked like a medieval city in San Francisco. It's just amazing how vulnerable, fragile civilization was. It's just completely unwinding.
Part of that is, you guys remember Hannah Arendt, and she said, you know, the one thing as a parent you're not allowed to practice is surrender. Throw your hands up and say, well, we can't guide you anymore. It's a brave new world. It's, you know, it's AI and it's this and that and TikTok and all sorts of things. We can't help you. Yeah. And that surrender is the end of civilization.
And this federal system is a great system. But here in California, we've lost 10 million people, 280,000 in the last 14 months. So their attitude is, I don't have to stay here. And now we're in this doom loop. So now we've raised income taxes on the top brackets from 13.3 to 14.2.
Good Lord.
As a result. And we only have 1% of the state population is paying 55% of the income tax.
And Joe wants to raise more taxes on the rich.
He does.
Yeah, they're not paying their way.
I couldn't believe that in the State of the Union when he said pay your fair share when his own son is facing felony tax avoidance charges. It's just surreal.
But look, isn't there going to be a backlash here? I mean, aren't millions of homes of America saying basically what you just said, Victor? I mean, everything is going to hell. We need a change regime here.
I think so. But the other thing what I don't understand, though, there is a wild card is that all of these institutions were traditionally liberal. And by that, I mean media, corporate boardroom, entertainment, K through 12, academia, and all that. But now they're not just liberal. They're almost Jacobin, strident. What I mean by that is if you do a Google search and you say, as I just did, May 2020 riots, the BLM and Antifa riot, you know what comes up for your first 20 searches? January 6th. And they have, what I'm getting at is the amount of money they have. Mark Zuckerberg gave $420 million last year. The ability to warp Google searches, the ability to get CIA agents to lie and say this laptop was authentic right before a debate in an election. I don't think we've ever seen the institutions so weaponized, regardless of their ideology. They have power that to affect public opinion in a way that...
But we've never seen them exposed. Everyone knew that J. Edgar Hoover exceeded his authority, but he never meddled in a presidential election.
No. I mean, the idea that the FBI would hire Christopher Steele, or the idea they would hire Twitter people to suppress the news they didn't like, we've never seen anything like that.
But isn't there a sense of that? And don't, in the end, aren't, I mean, I hate to sound like a one-trick pony and a stuck gramophone record, but aren't a lot of people going to say, look, I don't particularly care for Trump, but he's a strong man and he will stop the rot.
I think so. I just hope that they have a mechanism to voice that feeling that they're going to vote.
Yeah, yeah.
And
then it's on the up and up.
I just don't think that they have confidence that when you have 70% of the electorate mailing in a ballot and they're not holding the ballots with registrar's name or addresses or signatures, it's going to be very, he's going to have to get a 4-5% popularity margin in all these swing states. I think.
Yeah, I know. And it worries me. All right. Well, thank you for indulging me on the student thing. Let's make Conrad a two-trick pony, Victor, if it's all right with you. Conrad, I've been reading. Am I right that do we think there's now something less of a challenge or a risk from China because of collapse there and the collapse of Xi and some relative collapse and the economy, that more unlikely that they go after Taiwan? Am I reading this right, or is that just made up?
No, I think you're probably right. I mean, they obviously have a lot of economic problems. I mean, you men remember when Obama was president, you couldn't set foot out of doors without someone telling you China's about to pass the U.S. as the world's largest economy. It was going to happen in 2 years or 4 years or something. We haven't heard any of that for a long time, and they're not gaining on the U.S., and they have terrible debt problems. So I think that's an aspect. These failures in their real estate boom, these terrible financial failures that they're covering up, well, it's impeding them. And on the Taiwan thing, I've said all along that, and we've talked about it on this podcast, that they can't just conduct invasion, put 500,000 men into ships and send them across the Straits of Formosa. They'll all be drowned. So they would have to try and put an embargo on the island, surround it, and do what JFK threatened to do to Cuba during the missile crisis. But that is very hazardous. You know, the fact is they're not going to stop American and Japanese and Indian ships on the high seas bringing whatever they want to bring to Taiwan, I don't think. So I think they have to step back a little. But I think they don't look like they're in retreat because the United States is in such a state of disarray. So what you said is true, Bill, but the U.S. can basically turn things around in November. China is not really a rival to the U.S. It's not as strong a country. It has no resources.
We've got some pretty serious problems in our military. We're short 45,000 soldiers. And when you look at the demographic that's not enlisting, it's the people that they're demonizing. Remember Mark Milley and Lloyd Austin in 2021 said that there was a white supremacist terrorist group within the military. Then very quietly, they issued their report in December of 2023 and said, well, sorry, there was no such thing, but the damage had been done. And that particular demographic dies at twice their numbers in the population in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're not joining. And then we're going to have 7 years back.
Who are they? Who are they?
White males, so the middle classes. We're 7 years to restock javelins. We're behind on high. We're not producing war material. And we're using it at a fantastic rate in Ukraine and Israel. So I don't know. I think they also were the idea that we're going to spend $14 billion on these 11 big carriers when we're in an age of drones and small ships. There's a lot of things that are going on in the Pentagon. It's politicized. It's weaponized. And it's losing public. It's starting to go the way of the CIA and the FBI if somebody doesn't intervene. The generals are considered politicized. And they understand what they have to say and do to become promoted.
Well, Milley asked for that. His conduct was shocking, I thought.
Yeah.
But I mean, Victor, couldn't you deal with that by doing a public relations job at the Pentagon? Get rid of everybody above three stars and put in a sort of a, I don't know, a MacArthur or somebody, not as a general, but as a public relations person.
That's what you hear that the Heritage is Foundation is doing. They're going through some 20,000 names and auditing, and so that Trump, should he win, is not going to have, you know, Omarosa and Scaramucci type appointments. He's going to have these professional audit, and they're going to clean house. I don't know if that's going to happen if he should win, but it would be something that would help. But we have some real problems with we had these generals, you know, violating the code of military justice by calling the president a Nazi, Mussolini, a liar, he should be removed. We've got these Lloyd Austin characters that go right out of Raytheon, right into the Secretary of Defense. I think all of our most prominent four stars are on the boards of Lockheed, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Northrop. And so it needs a complete revision the Pentagon, and I just feel there's the people in the ranks you talk to don't feel they're going to be promoted on their battlefield efficacy or their strategy and tactics. It's going to be woke issues or social concerns or therapeutic grounds, and that's really kind of like the Soviet Commissar system of the 40s that they had. I mean, even Stalin got rid of it. You know, Conrad in 42, he said, if we get rid of all the commissars, we're not going to allow them to veto military judgments.
Meanwhile, he purged most of the good generals in the 30s.
Yeah, in the 30s he did. But we've got to do something with the Pentagon. It's got to be completely reformed, like the FBI.
Bill, you have a member of your family in the armed forces. I mean, I'm not asking for an indiscretion, obviously, but he sees a way forward, I assume.
He's discouraged by what he sees. I mean, he's out now. He was in the Marine Corps 4.5 years, but he's out now and not happy with what he sees and what he saw. So what about Ukraine? Oh, last thing on China. One flip of the button there is that, well, because things are worse for them, we're more at risk because one way to rescue a dying operation is to go to war with somebody else.
Especially when we're under Biden and we don't have any deterrence left. And there's a window. If they think Biden is a golden opportunity and he may not be there, that opportunity might be something to be worried about in the next 9-10 months.
Comment on that, Conrad, China?
Look, I think it is a country whose leadership group is now so large and so comfortable that risking a war with the United States and its allies is just too big a risk for too little gain. And, Mr. Nixon told me that, and Henry Kissinger also, they both said that Mao Zedong said when they discussed Taiwan in 72, China will not get to this subject for 100 years. And I don't know, but I think there's probably some some momentum behind that view.
Okay, good. And Ukraine?
Well, it's worrisome. I mean, we can't let it go down the drain, I don't think.
Yeah. I think, you know, in 108 years ago at Verdun, there was, from February to December, there was 650,000 combined dead and wounded. And I just looked at their, in August, they reached 600, and now people are suggesting there's 700 dead and wounded Russian and Ukrainian. And so it's worse than Verdun.
Wow.
And I think the biggest tragedy was someone convinced the Ukrainians that they've lost 12,000 of their population have left the country. They only have about 34 million. And I don't know who was the American or NATO advisor, but the idea that they were going to do a Patton-like spring offensive and try to break through that Maginot Line, I mean, it was cement and it was mines and drones. And
it was like Kursk. It was
absolutely. It was crazy. And they lost a lot of people and momentum. And I don't know. I think it's a stalemate. And when you mention to anyone in government, well, it looks to me like, not to me, but it looks like you might have to negotiate where they institutionalize the acquisition 10 years ago, the Crimea and Donbass, and maybe you can get them back to where they were in February of 2022. And in exchange for that, Putin can brag that he institutionalized that. And Ukraine is not in NATO, but it's armed to the teeth.
And with real guarantees.
With real guarantees that might stop the mass murder. One other thing, Bill and Conrad, it's very strange. Our schizophrenia on Israel and Ukraine.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, we say, Netanyahu, you have to have a wartime government with the opposition. Zelensky, if you want to suspend habeas corpus, cancel political parties, cancel it, fine. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu, you have to drop leaflets and text people you're coming. Well, if you're a Ukrainian, you send a missile into Crimea and it kills some Russians, who cares? Netanyahu, you have to have a ceasefire. Ukraine, don't dare have a ceasefire. Netanyahu, you have to be proportionate. Ukraine, you've got to be disproportionate to win. You've got to inflict more energy. And it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
It's really baffling, the Biden.
But isn't that traceable to the fundamental, apart from incompetence and a weak leader, the fundamental problem the Democrats have, that in the summer of love of 2020 and the peaceful protesting that caused billions of dollars of damage and scores of dead, they opened the back door to the irresponsible left. And now they're a big part of the party and they're trying to urge the Israel to defend itself while handing an olive branch to the Muslim population of Michigan and a few other places. I mean,
yeah, I think what you're saying is
suck and blow at the same time.
I think they're saying that Hamas, one thing also the disparity is, if you suggest to somebody that there's a clear symbiosis between the people in Gaza and Hamas, in other words, they cheered on 500 people, accompanying them and as a tag along to rape and kill and mutilate or to get a bounty on hostages, or they desecrated bodies, or they knew well that they were hiding Hamas beneath their hospitals, mosque, and that they're synonymous. People get very angry. Oh, no. If you say that about the Russian people are not all behind Putin. Oh, yes, they are. They're guilty. It's almost like we look at the Russian people as these villains in Hollywood movies, you know, with tattoos and orthodox, crazy.
Like we did in the 50s.
Yeah. And then we look at, as you say, with 250,000 Middle East students, we don't apply the same level of anger or disparagement against the people of Gaza that we do Russia.
What is the amount of money that's pending going to Ukraine?
You mean on the bill that's out there?
The latest is it $660 billion.
$660 billion?
No, 60.
I think we're all going to be up to about, I think if you count everything cumulative, we're getting near $200 billion.
The Europeans are actually pulling their weight, by the way. It is not fair to say they aren't. Britain just put in another $3 billion. I mean, you know, they're doing a serious job. But yeah, I was going to say, with a strong Secretary of State, I think you could broker the deal in Ukraine. I mean, Baker or Schultz are certainly
You're right about that. The problem is to win for a tiny country that has 1/10 of the GDP, 1/30th of the area, one fourth of the population. They would have to do things, you know, in classical military strategy, hit depots inside Russia, sink the Black Sea fleet, hit transportation hubs that supply the Russian front. And to do that is insane because everybody discounts, oh, Putin's lying. He would never use a nuclear. But if they started to do that systematically and started to really win, I think he would react, either going into a Baltic country or using some kind of tactical nuclear weapon. And they think that's crazy, but I don't think it's crazy that he would do
it. He would do it in desperation, but you'd have to catch it at the cusp there. But you need somebody to – I mean, Putin has basically said what his terms are. Now, his terms may have become harsher since he's gained some ground, but something can be done there along the lines you said, Victor.
Yeah,
but I don't want to get on the president's back too much here, but I don't think it helps for him to just declare, as he did last night, that not only is Trump Hitler, but Putin is Hitler. I mean, you know, everybody the Democrats don't like is Hitler. You just can't do that.
Well, it's always bad to carry a twig and be loud. So he can be quiet. I mean, they made fun of Trump for doing the opposite. He said he loved Kim Jong-un, and then he told him, if you dare do that again, this is what's going to happen to you. And he said the same thing about Putin. He told Putin reportedly he would attack the Kremlin if he invaded, and then he praised Putin. That was his method. It was exactly the opposite of Biden. Praise your enemy and then privately threaten him. Don't publicly humiliate him. Biden's is publicly humiliate your enemy, but then don't really be tough on him. And so that's how we lost deterrence, I think, in Afghanistan, the Chinese, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Look, the fundamental correlation of forces is overwhelmingly on the side of the West. Yeah. All we need is a bit of leadership, and not just in Washington. I mean, we've got an incompetent government in Canada, an incompetent government in England, and a pretty mixed bag elsewhere. So we all have to pull up our socks, but we can do that.
Last night, when he mentioned Ukraine and he attacked Trump, he wanted to say we've had four administrations and there was only one in which Putin didn't leave his homeland and cross an international border, and that was during Trump's. He sure did during George W. Bush and during Obama and during Biden. He invited this war when after that debacle in Afghanistan, and he was asked about a possible invasion, and he said it depends on whether it's major or minor. He suspended he did when he came in. Everybody forgets that now. He suspended the military aid to Ukraine because he wanted to reassure Putin that he wasn't trying to.
All right, I don't feel we've done justice to the Israel part, which you raised, the hypocrisy vis-a-vis Israel and Ukraine. But hey,
can I ask on that subject, what is the insight of you guys about how close on the military side, the straight military operation, the IDF is to getting their hands around the throat of the terrorist apparatus of Hamas? I mean, they apparently have confined them into this Rafid or what the place is called. Is Israel quite close to being able, in straight military terms, to exterminate its military enemy?
I hear they need about eight to 10 weeks, and they feel they can cover all of Gaza and get them out. And people I've talked to said they're not sure that even half of the hostages are still alive. They won't give any name or list of them. They keep dangling the idea there might be some alive, but the Hamas will not give actual numbers. And they're afraid.
Well, the Israeli government has made it clear they're not going to be held to ransom anyway.
And if Hamas survives and we call off Israel with a ceasefire, it's going to be a big victory for Hamas.
Yeah, any survival of the, I don't mean the people who vote Hamas, of the terrorist apparatus of Hamas. If that survives, it's a victory.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, don't you guys agree? If Israel does what it claims it's going to do and is clearly able to do, that is a huge step forward in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's in our interest too, because it'll detour Hezbollah and the Houthis and everybody else if they destroy Hamas. And
it won't do the Iranian status any good either.
I think so. But I don't know. When you look at the world's commercial waterways, Conrad, I mean, the South China Sea, the Black Sea, the Straits of Hormuz, the Red Sea, they don't seem like they're very safe places under Joe Biden.
Look, on this, again, we're kind of getting down to short strokes here, but I do not understand this Houthi business. I mean, the strike force on the carrier Eisenhower alone could eliminate all the Houthi rocket sites. Why isn't it happening?
Because I think he feels that people will say that he's Jimmy Carter, that he came in and there were hostages taken or Russia invaded Afghanistan. The whole world fell apart. And if he does everything piecemeal with pinpricks, he can at least stabilize it so there's no theater war on his watch in an election year.
Well, this is Vietnamitis. I mean, you know, you can't make war and peace at the same time. I mean, if you're conducting, General MacArthur was right. In war, there's no substitute for victory.
Yeah, I mean, for all Trump's faults, I mean, he did destroy ISIS, and he did deter Iran, and he did kill Soleimani, and he got the Houthis on the terrorist list, and they were quiet. He cut off Hamas. He cut off the UN aid, crooked people. And Jake Sullivan was right. He said, we inherited a very quiet portfolio.
And implicit in a lot of what you've been saying is Israel, one example, others. That address last night, that State of the Union, to end where we started, was aimed not at the middle, but at the left, progressive part of the party, wasn't it?
Absolutely. He started out on the one hand, on the other, and then he accepted the Hamas death toll, which is bogus. And
right.
Then the second half of it was just a diatribe against Israel. And
yeah.
I think that's, it was seen that way.
The 30,000 civilian dead is complete fiction.
No.
The health ministry of Gaza.
He's doing this for political reasons. And I think also there's a sense in the left wing of the Democratic Party that they have been able to conflate Jewish. They always said that Jews were different than Israel, but the hounding of Jews and the anti-Semitism wouldn't continue if Joe Biden had stood up and said, we're not going to allow this in this country. And I've directed the attorney general to investigate these universities for conspiracy or cost. He could stop it. He could deport people on green cards that were engaging in violence against Jews, and he won't do it. And I think there's a sense in the Democratic Party that the number of foreign students, the number of the Arab American community, the money from the middle is just too great now. And that constituency is more important than our support for Israel.
And that's a shocking development, if true. On the other hand, I think the Republicans are basically picking up Jewish support, aren't they?
I hope so. I mean, it seems...
I don't know.
It would. I don't know. It's got a long tradition of supporting the left, but
I don't know.
I was watching Schumer clap when he was talking about the 30,000 that Israel killed. I mean, it's going to be. I think the Jewish Americans that are left wing and Democrat look at the Democratic Party, and they're shocked. But if it's join the squad and join. You know, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and the Obamas are joining the MAGA people. They'll pick the left for cultural and social reasons, if anything else.
Still, the polls show that about 2/3 of Americans still support Israel.
Yeah,
so the Jews themselves may be more wobbly than the non-Jews, but
I know
the support's still there.
Overwhelming support for Israel, and for all the attention the media gives all these protests and the tiny little group of 1.5% of the Michigan electorate. It's just amazing how many people support Israel.
You see, it's slightly like the Spanish Civil War. Most Americans supported the Republicans.
Yeah.
But 90% of the Roman Catholics supported the Loyalists.
Yeah.
And Roosevelt was in this conundrum where he needed the Catholic vote, so he finessed it. But no one was really expecting the U.S. to intervene there anyway. Here, Biden's trying to finesse it, but he's not astute enough to do it. And obviously, the United States is more of a factor with Israel than it was with Spain in the 30s. But there is a way to try and, you know, get around these conundra. But Biden isn't a virtuoso who knows how to do that.
I think he's shocked how many anti-Semitic people are in academia, in foundations, in the Democratic Party, in the administrative bureaucratic state at all levels.
And how many of them are Jews, too?
Yeah, and I think the CIA is completely anti-Israel. I think a lot of people in the Pentagon are anti-Israel. I think the whole DEI woke movement is anti-Israel. And it's just amazing what people are saying publicly, you know. And
yeah, the Jews are seen by all those who object to the whites. The Jews are the worst of the whites.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's a very strange state of affairs.
You're both very generous, and I thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Bill.
We'll see you guys.
Claude, that does it for today's show. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to thebillbennettshow.com. You can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at William J. Bennett. You can like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Please share the podcast with your family and friends. We'll catch up next week. God love you.